tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 449 of the Toonami Escape Podcast. I'm C. Kohler, and with me tonight is Seda.
Hello.
And Crocodile.
Good evening.
Welcome to a new lineup for Toonami this past weekend. We've got the return of Mashal, a new season of Blue Exorcist, and one fewer show, or one fewer premiere, I should say. As far as news goes, I really only had one thing, and that is they did do a game review this weekend. It was for a game called Baby Steps, which is one of those sort of like goofy physics-based games where you try to, you know, make a guy walk like Quap, kind of.
Screamer bait, as some might say.
Yeah. I've heard it's kind of a, it's obviously like a goofy premise where you like control like the legs like individually or whatever, but I heard the game is actually like a pretty good game, like overall. Even beyond just the superficial, you know, goofiness of it.
Yeah, I think the like game mechanics look fun. I wish it didn't look so like gross, but I guess that's just what they're going for.
Yeah,
I think that's part of charm or the appeal.
That's its aesthetic, right? I get it. I look at it and I'm like, ugh. I guess one thing to note about this though is that they didn't give it a score.
Was there a reason for that? I didn't watch live this week, so did they
just like cut off at the end and just like stop the review? Basically, they didn't say it. Would say like forgot. This game is too. It's not like this game is too wacky to be scored. We can't possibly measure its divine awesomeness. It wasn't anything like that. They kind of just like petered out, basically. Like, I mean, it wasn't like the he cut out or anything. Like, they intentionally ended the review, but didn't really explain why they didn't give it a score. They just didn't.
Well, I hope it isn't because of all that complaining I was doing. I can't imagine it was. But I was complaining a number of episodes back about the fact that they shouldn't bother with the scores. And I never really was that serious about it. Like, if they want to do scores. I don't care. But, like, it'd be funny if that was the reason. Because I was, like, giving them a hard time.
It is a kind of hard game to rate, I guess, because it's such a weird game and premise and goal. I don't know what the reviews like for the game look like in, you know, normal game review outlets. I have not looked into that at all. But I could understand it being kind of a hard game to review, just so, like, you know, not, it's just kind of a weird experience. It's just a weird thing. So maybe they just never decided not to give a score because it's just so weird, I guess.
Seda, you review games professionally. Could you give this game a score?
Well, I will say that sometimes there are certain games that come out that we do a scoreless review. Okay. Like, usually there's a certain circumstance to it. Like, random example, the System Shock 2 remaster came out like a couple months ago, several months ago, and we didn't score that review. And the reason why was like, okay, this is a remaster of like a 20-year-old game, you know, in a modern day, like, how do you score that based on what it was back then or what it is now? So we didn't, but that's just kind of a certain situation. So maybe they just decided in this case, let's just not score it, or maybe they just forgot.
Yeah, no big deal either way. I just thought it was probably the most interesting thing about the review. It's just from a Toonami standpoint, because obviously, you know, a game review is a game review, and yeah, I mean, it looked fine, but yeah, I just thought it was interesting. I wasn't the only one. A bunch of other people that were in our group watch was noticing like they didn't give it a score, kind of breaking the trend there. Okay, well, like I said, we've got only four premieres this week, but they're all with the exception of Bleach, which is just continuing. The other three are all kind of premiering in a way. They're, or in the very least, one's a premiere and two are like new seasons starting. So
because One Piece is starting a new arc, basically. Is that the
new arc, right? Well, when we get there, they don't really start the arc yet. We'll get to that. But let's go ahead and begin. And now leading off the block is Bleach.
Oh, man, you got it.
Bleach, The Thousand-Year Blood War, Core 2, Episode 11, Too Early to Win, Too Late to Know. I always write these episode titles down, and I don't think about what they mean until this moment when I'm reading it aloud. But I'm sure it's in. I'm sure there's that make that probably makes sense to something. Okay, I'll do the quick rundown. So the episode starts with this really long sort of flashback lore drop where Yuha Baha is sitting at a table with the head, Squad Zero guy.
He said his name so many times and we can't remember it. It's kind of tragic.
I'm going to share the names. Unfortunately, I don't have images. He's the top one here. Ichibe Hyosube, something like
there
that.
There you go. Like, it's a plot point about saying his name. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's apparently that's a touchy subject with him. He's not, Yuha Baha is not supposed to be saying his name aloud. And it kind of makes him mad. I'm not going to get all this right because they really dump a lot on you in this scene. Actually, I feel like I really need to go back and watch it again because I probably missed something important. But here are the main takeaways I had from it. One, they were trying to form some kind of non-aggression pact with the Quincy's. It's explained. Yuha Baha starts to get into like this big ordeal about like, why do people have to die? Why does this have to be this way? And it's explained that the Soul King invented death, that he created death as a concept and that everyone has to do it. Yuha Baha apparently in the past used to have like a second set of like pupils and like his eyes.
Yeah, that was weird.
Yeah, it was weird. It was kind of neat in that it was kind of like it gave him like super sensory perception, but it was kind of goofy in that it made it look like he was cross-eyed sometimes. I don't know.
Like his eyes were offset.
And I was a little confused because then the other guy, Ichibe, had like this eyes, similar eyes in like his hand. Like he yes. like, took them and stole them.
Yeah, I'll say this scene is actually anime original. But it serves to expand on some concepts from the manga. And a lot of things that play out here will make more sense in the third core. Like, a lot of things that come up here are kind of elaborated upon or like, oh, I just remember seeing from there. So this is kind of confusing, it kind of makes sense, but doesn't make sense at the same time. But a lot of things mentioned here do get brought up again in future episodes. I'll just say that. So, like, if you're confused, that's fair. You'll be, I guess, a little less confused moving forward, though still confused because of Bleach, and Bleach never explains everything well, I feel. But some of the things here that kind of don't seem to make any sense, at least some of them make more sense later. Maybe not all of them, but some of them.
Yeah. And I mean, like I said, there was a lot explained here that felt really important, but it kind of goes by so fast. I feel like it didn't really sink in. But I don't think it's a big deal if I don't know or don't remember. But just let it be known that there was a lot that happened here. So we kind of cut back. Oh, and one last thing about that scene too. You mentioned Seda, the hand that the guy had the eyeball in the hand, and that he says that's the Soul King. Like he was saying it like the hand itself that he was holding out was the Soul King itself, or provided by the Soul King, or something.
Yeah, it was a little confusing. Like, what precisely is a Soul King? Like, this kind of weird spirit within his arm, or just like in a vortex of space in the room, or something? Like, I wasn't.
Yeah,
I'm not sure what this entity of the Soul King is. Kind of strange.
So after that scene, we kind of flash back to real time, back to normal time. We're in the science area, and our main team of Ichigo, Orohime, Chad.
Urushi.
Yes. They're all going to get ready to blast off, and then Ganju appears. Now, can you guys explain who is Ganju?
He was a pretty major character in like the second arc of the show, which was the Rescue Rukia arc. I don't remember like exactly his like position, but he's not a Soul Reaper, but he lives like in the Soul Society, and he has his like older sister who is like he talks, you know, obviously his older sister is a competent one, and he kind of like he basically mooches off her competence and whatnot. But I forget what exactly his like role is. It's been so long.
But yeah, Sato's exactly right. He's a major character from much earlier in the series. So like, you've been watching Bleach all the way through. You're well acquainted with him and his deal. So he's not like a nobody. I mean, he's not a powerful character. Like he's definitely like a side character, but he played a big role in the Soul Society arc. And like, Alzi's sister is important too. I think you saw her earlier in this arc. I think either the first core or the second one. But like, she's both of them kind of work with like transportations and like explosives and kind of like they're kind of like mechanics, both of them, that kind of deal with like Soul Society kind of like business and whatnot. They live like outside the Serete, and kind of more on that. You know, there's a Serete and there's kind of like, I don't necessarily like say, want to say the slums, but kind of like,
yeah, like the Soul Society is, I think, what they call it.
Well, I think the Serete is the main city with which the 13 guards all house in, that kind of what's the Walden section. And then I think beyond Serete is the Soul Society, which includes that and everything outside of it as well. I think is I have the organization correct.
It's funny you mentioned that, because like, I don't think I've ever seen that. And so I didn't even know there was anything outside the round city that they always show in the show. So that's interesting.
Yeah, that was something covered in earlier arcs, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, having not seen it, that's just, like I said, it's never been brought up to me. But anyway, he apparently is coming along because he's supposed to know something important, even though when they kind of question him, he doesn't really know the details. So, I don't know what he's supposed to bring.
He brought a map to the Royal Palace or something, or that's what he was saying?
He called himself like the expert on the Soul King or the Soul Palace or whatever. And then, yeah, when they pushed him on it, he's like, oh, I'm not really sure. This really just kind of feels like almost just like a kind of a full circle, like almost like a fan service thing. Like, hey, you remember this guy, right? He's going to tag along.
Okay. Well, my next note is a little vague. I wish I had been more verbose, but it just says that Stern Ritter W bends things. So I know the Stern Ritter W shows up.
Yeah. So basically what happens is that, he shows up and the, Senyumada, I forget her name. The Weaver woman of the Royal Guard.
I posted the image. It's Senjumaru Shutara, the Divine General of the North.
Oh, there we go.
Guard.
Okay, yeah. She sends out. So you have the Soldak, which are the Quincy Grunts, and then Yubara sends them out to attack the Royal Palace, and then what's her name? Senjumaru sends out their basically version of grunts to fight back. And while they're trying to fight back, their weapons are kind of warped and distorted by W, who kind of can warp space basically.
That's right.
Hit him. But then Senjumaru just like bitch slaps him and throws him off the side of dead, because he's obviously part of Royal Guard, and W is kind of a creepy weirdo, but like, she beats him pretty easily. And then the soldats, or the grunts from the Quincy's, and the Royal have the guards or whatever, who are the grunts from the Soul Society, then they start fighting a bit and whatnot. But yeah, W just comes, flexes for a little bit, and then dies.
Yeah, so basically, here, I'll try to use their names, because I know I keep saying her and him and they. Senjumaru basically explains that her power, being of this, like, the ability to control like cloth in a certain extent, basically turns his own clothes against him, and then like weaves that into him and creates spikes and kills him. I guess he's kind of like the first person to attack. He's thus killed by sewing, basically.
He's in and out in like 10 minutes, or not even that.
Well, not even that, like 2 minutes, basically. Yeah. We then quickly cut back to the rocket, and Yorichi is explaining the Soul King a little bit, but I didn't even write down what she explains. So it's just something about the Soul King.
I think this is the part when Ganju is kind of like, he was saying he was an expert, and then they were kind of doubting him. And then there was like, there was a sad scene where they're like, this reminds us of the, when we had to go rescue Rukia and we were all here. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Uryu.
When we cut back, it turns out that Yuha Vaha's own personal Royal Guard has arrived. And this is made up of 4 members. Their letters, I'll start out with their letters. It's X, C, M, and D. I've got Seda's great guide here to kind of go through these.
But just like read the names and don't look at anything
else. Just the names. Okay. So it's C the Compulsory. His name is Pernada Parngingjaz.
That's the weird, goofy looking one with the, he's just like a cape with a face. It looks like a Jawa from Star Wars or something.
Yeah.
You don't know what he looks like, really.
We've got D, the Death Dealing, and his name is Askin Nak Levar.
That's the one who looks like Aizen.
Yeah, yes. He's been around for a while. He actually just got promoted to Royal Guard like shortly before they went upstairs.
He even made a comment like, hey, I'm the only one from the battlefield.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. And that's how I remember him too, is like he's the one that has a very similar look and hairstyle to Aizen. Then we've got M the Miracle. His name is Gerard Valkyrie, an actual pronounceable name. And then the last one, who actually plays the largest role in this episode, his X, the X-Axis. His name is Lille Barrow. And he's the guy that's the sniper rifle guy.
Yep.
So I think I just want to mention a funny comment from Grex with the MOOC kind of formation. But basically, Gerard would be the big, boisterous, strong guy, be the cool customer. I would think asking would be the troll, and then what even is that would be Pernada.
Yeah, what even is that? Yeah.
Yeah, to be clear, one of our former podcast members said he appreciates that the Royal Guard has the classic four types of elite MOOC: the big, boisterous, strong guy, cool customer, troll, and what even is that? like archetypes.
Well, Senjumaru isn't particularly impressed at first, but then X just straight up shoots her dead, puts a big hole right in her freaking head.
Or did he?
I guess that's true. It is, at first, it looks like that happens. And that's kind of when we cut to commercial. It's like, oh my gosh, this guy's super powerful. But we come back from the commercial break and we learn, oh no, it was an illusion. Suddenly, I liked how they did this. Suddenly, you what looked like the surrounding area starts to flap in the wind as if it's like a fake like curtain. And it turns out that it was all just an illusion. She's not dead either. And I don't know which of the guards it is. One of them, it may have been Ichibei, I'm not sure, but one of them creates a kind of cage around everything. They end up calling it a womb for some reason.
That's the pink-haired big woman, Kirio Hikafune, makes this big like tree of life cage sort of thing.
Yeah, and then apparently like this womb is, no one can escape it. It's impossible to get out. If you attack it, it just absorbs your power and becomes even stronger, is what they say.
So this is the tech of Reishin, which is obviously what Quincy weapons are made out of.
Right. Yeah, and their Reishi attacks just make it stronger. And at the same time, this is, of course, you just mentioned her, but then all of Squad Zero show up at this moment. They all kind of assemble here. And then it says, oh yeah. And then I think everyone's favorite Squad Zero member, Oisu, who is like, you know, the Divine General of the West. He's the sword guy who created the you know.
Tetsu, I think is in his name of Tetsu. Is that pronounced?
How do you pronounce that?
I think it's Oisu, right? Oisu? It's got a line over the O, so I think it's Oe. Oitsu, I think is how you say it. I could be wrong.
Was saying it?
No, I have no idea how to pronounce it. But yeah, he's this Anbakuto guy. He pulls out his sword that's apparently so sharp that it can't be like put in a sheath. So that's why
I like that.
Little pool instead. This little like water pool thing, special water. And then he like pulls it out and then he gets into like, yeah, some sort of like gel or liquid. And then he there's a little fight with him and Lille Barrow where he's just shooting the energy Reishi blast with his sword. And then he knocks out the other guy, the Atskin, not Aizen dude. And you know, he kind of beats him up. Or as you put in your notes, cuts everyone down.
Yeah, I mean, he's ruthless. Like really, it's pretty amazing in this scene. And so it looks like things are going pretty bad for the bad guys here, for the Quincy's. But Yuha Vaha kind of impresses everybody because he just like he takes some little object and throws it and kind of does like a Trafalgar Law where he just like trades places with it or something.
I was thinking more like Fourth Hokage.
Okay.
With his old kunai and warping.
It looked like one of those things that they used to capture Bankais. It looked like that to me. I mean, yeah. I could be wrong. But that's what it looked like.
Okay. Regardless, he throws it outside the womb and it's able to teleport out there. So he gets outside it and he's getting ready to go up against Ichibei. Or he does actually kind of gets close to him, I think.
That's how the episode ends, basically.
Yeah. So pretty exciting episode. Really, really, the battle is begun big time up on the Soul King's palace. So that's pretty much the episode. I guess I'll give you guys an opportunity to talk about anything I didn't mention or that you want to talk about. Crocodile, you can go first.
I would just say it's very much keeping in line of most Bleach battles and where you think, like, aha, I've defeated you. Nah, ha, ha. I've not been defeated. You've been defeated. Nah, ha, 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 ha. We've been, you know, just that back and forth thing. And so, given that there are another episode or two left in the season, another season after that, and then another season after that that hasn't premiered in Japan yet, you can probably go figure out when you think the back and forth, who won, who didn't, where it eventually ends up at. You can probably figure that out. But it is just still kind of funny just how it just plays into typical Bleach patterns. But it's still very entertaining nonetheless.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I find it pretty entertaining as well. And I think even if these, I don't know how long this Quincy Elite Four are going to stick around. Maybe they're not, but I did like seeing them. I mean, we obviously haven't seen all of them. So what about you, Seda?
Yeah, this definitely felt like Bleach at its, for better or worse. You had some kind of wacky characters, cool fights, and abilities with the kind of caveats that Crocodile mentioned, you know, introducing characters out of nowhere. One of them getting kind of off in like we said, like 2 minutes, disappears and then disappears. And like, yeah, that kind of feels like something Bleach would do. I have a feeling basically the Squad Zero and the Quincy Elite Four are probably going to like knock each other out. And then I'm assuming they have to leave some room for, Ichigo and friends to take out, you know, to have something to do when they get up there. So against Uryu and Jugrum or whatever his name is that are also up there. So yeah, basically, you know, everything's converging on this battlefield, I suppose, up in the Soul Kingdom.
Overall, pretty good episode, in my opinion. Just kind of fun to see. We're seeing the big battles happen now. This is what everything's been leading to. Well, all right, let's move on to the next show on the block, which is Blue Exorcist. Blue Exorcist, Beyond the Snow Saga, Episode 1, Ambition. Beyond the Snow Saga is not easy to say. It's like a tongue twister.
Especially when we're saying Soul Society on the tongue.
Yeah. So this whole beginning of this episode is a huge recap. The round table at the,
like the Exorcist headquarters. The Vatican.
Yeah, what is this place called? The Vatican, I guess? Yeah, it's the Vatican. Yeah.
Is it? Oh, okay. I was going to say the Justice League. I was about to say this Legion of Doom, but obviously they're the good guys, so I was going to say the Justice League, but
We do get, like, I didn't write them down, but we did get a couple of new names. Like, we got the names of those sort of, like, heads at the head of the table that are, like, you can't really see their faces. It did prop their name on the screen, but I didn't take the time to write it down.
I did notice there's a couple of like characters that weren't really named yet that I'm not sure we've seen before. If we have seen them before, they've only in passing. There was like some bigger guy with something goofy on his head.
There's some characters that feel like they're brand new, but
yeah, I don't remember seeing them before. Maybe they're only shown in passing. I don't remember. But yeah, some big guy with something like weird on his head. And then there was like some short, small, older woman also at the table. Like, you know, head, I don't know if they're important or not, but like, okay, they're clearly leadership positions of some sort in the Vatican. Along with those three, like, I don't know, the heads, as you call them. They're just like wrapped up in bunches of clothes.
Yeah, it's really weird. I'm sure those people will come up at some point. I mean, those two, the ones in the robes must be like the leaders or the main president of the council or something. Basically, it also is mentioned during this meeting that the ultimate goal of the Illuminati is to create a vessel for Satan, which that might have been said before, but I don't remember that.
So I guess that must be what the aim of immortality serum is for. My understanding was that was for to cure Lucifer, I guess, but it's actually for Satan to give an immortal physical body. Is that the plan, I guess?
Something like that.
Yeah, it seems likely, yeah.
So I was always a little confused. Like, what was the goal of Ninetales exactly? Was it that Ninetales has extreme longevity for a demon or something? I never totally put that together. Did you guys, or did I forget something?
No, I never quite understood it either. I thought it was just that they wanted to control it, but I don't know to what end.
I'm trying to remember, there was a scene in the lab with Gedoin where they were talking about some of the other like Illuminati members like Toto. And I think they were trying to just like Toto is like a creation of some sort, like mixing of human and demon. And so like they're trying to create like soldiers. There was some phrase they used. I'm trying to remember what they called them, like Chosen One or something like that. It wasn't Chosen One, but it was they gave them some title or name. So it sounded maybe it was along that line.
Yeah, there is going to be some like ultimate goal of like merging humanity and demons or something, because they don't want there to be humans and demons that are separate. So maybe that's part of that experiment to like merge them. I don't know.
I guess Toto did basically absorb a phoenix, which gave him kind of immortality. Though I guess he's whatever he is now is kind of in line with that. But I don't know if I ever understood Ninetales to be like eating death in the same way that phoenixes did. So I don't know. I never totally got that, but maybe it was trying to produce another Toto. But I don't know. It never 100% made sense to me. But maybe I'm just.
Yeah. I think that's remained to be seen. I think we don't really quite know quite yet. So the only other real thing to note about this whole scene is that Angel is quite angsty and doesn't like Lightning at all. Lightning really gets under his skin. We cut back to the school and we learn that they're moving up the exams. This is, of course, all the students are like really upset and they're curious. Why is this happening? Why is this happening? Which gets explained in a minute. But it really ultimately it's just about the fact that the war is progressing. Things are getting more and more dangerous. Too many demons are getting into the real world. And so they need to like speed up everything. They need to get more and more exorcists into the mix for fighting. And so that's why the exams are moving up.
There's actually a pretty nice scene here. And we can talk about it for the second half of the episode too, between Suguro and Izumo. Basically, I appreciate this scene and also what they do with Suguro in the second half of the episode, because I feel like a lot of like shonen and anime and manga, like once a character like has their arc, they're like done. And then they're just kind of like, they just kind of stick around and they don't really contribute a whole lot anymore because they're no longer the focus and they're not going to be the focus anymore. But I think it was sort of a nice kind of like reconciliation of the two, like what they're, why they're still there, what they're going for. Are they going to take the exam and whatnot? I just appreciate having like two side characters interact with each other in this way.
I like that scene a lot too, for the same reason that it's kind of addressing this. It's basically what I was about to get to that, but yeah, Izumo is consoling Suguro in this moment, but it's also about like those characters reflecting on the new directions in their lives. Because obviously Izumo no longer has to do what she was doing before to save her little sister. So she's actually, as a character, addressing this openly about the fact that, like, you know, now I have to figure out what my new, you know, goal in life is. And so I think Suguro is going through this similar thing.
Izumo is going to become now the Exorcist Queen as a new goal in life.
I'd be for that.
In all seriousness, that is a good thing to point out. And I think, yeah, I think it's that is a true real problem. A lot of shows that kind of characters stop mattering or become more like background dressing once their quote unquote arc is over. So then these characters just take a moment and be like, okay, I had a goal A, things change, now my thing is goal B. And you see Suguro go through this later in episode. I'm sure you're going to get into that. But yeah, I think it reflects well on both characters, and I think reflects well on the generally the character writing for this series.
Yeah, and I mean, like, with Izumo particularly, because, like, they kind of address the fact that she's actually being nicer now than she would have in the past. But then they also kind of, like, when she gets called out on it, then she starts being more tsundere again, and she's like, I'm not being like that. But, like, it's already the cat's out of the bag, right? So it's like they're kind of having their cake and eating it too, but I like the fact that they even... Because, like, you're right. I think in a worse show, they wouldn't even have addressed it. Like, the characters just would have acted the way they always acted, and that wouldn't have been right, so...
Izumo's character, like, person, like, no one's personality does a complete 180 even after necessarily a traumatic event. They're, like, they changes, and I think that's a reflection of that, that she's not a totally new person, but she is still different, too, so... I think that maintaining that balance is important and good.
Yeah, I think they did it right here. So everyone, all the students kind of go to this sort of assembly thing. Mephisto's there, and he's like, he's basically saying everything I just said about, like, oh, we're moving the exams up and we got to get more exorcists and blah, blah, blah. And to help me with this, we're going to have this new guy come, and it's going to be Lightning, Lewis Light. He's going to teach here. And while this is happening, suddenly a whole bunch of hobgoblins, like, break free from under the floor. I don't know why they were there.
It seemed like to me there was a setup on Mephisto, but maybe I was wrong, but it seemed like that to me.
Yeah, it was sort of unexplained. I think it's fair to say it was just one of Mephisto's tricks or whatever, something he'd do, one of his antics.
Well, the hobgoblins are dispatched quite quickly via Lightning, much to Suguro's surprise, and he even, like, acknowledges the fact that, like, taking down these hobgoblins is going to take this exceedingly long chant that's going to be very difficult. And Lewis Lightning just starts the chant out and then goes, and so on, and then it, like, works. And then Suguro's, like, shocked. He's like, how did he do that? He didn't even complete the chant, which ends up being something that they talk about.
Literally yada yada yada, the demons of death.
Yeah. Yep. And, like, it's not like a joke. It's, like, literally part of his skill. So we get the commercial break. We come back. Lewis Light standing in the classroom. He's now going to teach the class. Our main students are there, but then they're also surrounded by all these other students. And everyone's, like, excited to learn from the Lightning. You know, he's so amazing. And he starts going into his, like, spiel, and Lightning is like, he's like saying, ah, I think demons are great. I'm really excited to learn and meet them. And then, like, I'm pretty much all the other students just leave at that point. They're like, this guy's a weirdo, right? And only our core group stays. And then for some reason he draws, like, what are these symbols? And he draws basically the PlayStation symbols on the chalkboard, and they're like, what is this? And I think, I forget who, one of the students is like, well, those are the PlayStar controller buttons.
It's Rin, of course.
Okay. And I don't remember what he was talking about with it. What was he making a point of with those symbols? I don't remember.
I don't either.
I don't think it was important. But he basically makes a point that the fact that he's just really, really good at summoning. He's really, really good at it. It's like it's so effortless to him. And Suguro is just kind of like taken aback by this guy. And he's like, he's starting to have this inner struggle about the fact that it basically, I'm not going to do this justice. You might be able to say it better, but like Suguro is saying, like, he's asking Lewis, like, how are you able to do these things? And Lewis is kind of like mocking him to a certain degree, not really like aggressively, but he's just saying, I don't know, I just do it. And it's like, Suguro makes a big point about the fact that I need ambition. I have to have ambition in my life to accomplish things.
Yeah, I think Lightning was going on about, like, oh, my entire family was killed by demons, and he starts breaking out laughing like he was doing the whole like shonen sad backstory thing. But we're like, no, actually, that's, I was just fucking with you guys. I'm just like a guy who thinks demons are cool and apply myself and work out, basically.
Yeah. And yeah, Light is just like basically saying like, I just like the world. I think the world is cool and interesting. And I think demons are interesting and I can, you know, it's really easy for me, but this really gets under Suguro's skin to a certain extent because he like doesn't understand how Lightning can be so talented and so driven to be so like good at what he does and be so aloof, because Suguro's whole identity has been about like having to have serious ambition in order to accomplish things. And this whole scene kind of goes on while basically Lightning has him and Rin cleaning, like, I guess, like, I don't know, it was like office, I guess, which is like dirty and filthy, like everything to do with Lightning. I guess Lightning is just like a slob. And while this is happening, Rin gets eaten by a mimic box. So he's kind of like in the box in the background, like struggling and being like, hey, help me, while the serious scene is going on.
He pretty much spends the rest of the episode in that box.
Yeah, pretty much. Suguro stumbles across this sort of demon card game, and like he accidentally jumps it on the floor. And when this happens, it's explained to him that these cards will now appear, and if you don't take them down, serious, powerful demons will appear. And he starts, and like Lewis is kind of using this as an opportunity to test Suguro.
Yeah, so the way that Suguro approaches this, he like the cards are like summoning demons, and basically like the language that they like appear in or whatever is like the language that he has to like know to, you know, like counter it. And he's like, he kind of mutters to himself, like, of course he knows the Japanese ones, he's learning like Latin ones, and he knows some of the non-Japanese ones, but then there's like a Hindu curse, and he's like, I don't know Hindu, what do I do here? I'm gonna grab my gun. He's just gonna like shoot it, I guess, with like holy bullets, and it doesn't work. And he's kind of failing at this point. And basically, I know I'm stealing your job of describing the episode. Light basically says, you're approaching this wrong. Go for the, like, just burn the card. Or, yeah, I think that's what he does. He burns the card. Just like, go for the source. Don't go for the summoning. Go for the source. And he just burns it.
Right. Rather than like employing demons, some exercise 101, he was way overthinking it and basically making a big issue from stuff that didn't need to be.
Kind of, it seems like the moral here is that, Suguro is like all wound up and he's like super serious, and Light is probably on the other end of the spectrum where he's just like so casual and aloof about everything, but basically kind of just telling Suguro you need to like relax a little bit and let things come more naturally. And even regardless to all of everything that happens here, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, he does ultimately decide to make Suguro his apprentice.
Yeah. And by the way, it is not my job to give these rundowns. You guys are more than welcome to step in and do them if you want to. Gives me a break, if anything. But yes, I agree completely. And yeah, and you mentioned something that I should have mentioned earlier, which is Suguro is so enamored by Lightning. He wants Lightning to be his like mentor. He wants to be his apprentice. And like at beginning, Lightning's like, I'm not going to bother. Why would I do that? You know, but after he sees what Suguro is capable of, he's like, okay, I'll go ahead and make you my apprentice now, which is interesting to me for another reason, which is like, I kind of thought the Suguro story was kind of not going to be like, seems like they're really putting a lot of him in the spotlight here. It's like, we just had a Suguro arc recently, and it just seems like okay, it's interesting.
Well, you don't need a character that can have more than one arc, I don't think.
I agree. I'm not saying he can. I'm just, like, surprised. I'm like, I thought we'd be moving on to another character or something, but no, it's Suguro we're kind of focusing on here, which is just different. I don't know.
I kind of like it. I hope, like, the season doesn't focus on him entirely, because we've kind of already had that, but I like giving that character a little bit of a character growth carrot still to go after, you know, alongside everything else that's going on. So.
Yeah,
it's definitely more of a like fiction thing where like characters have like one arc and they're done. Like, I don't say necessarily like all this nonsense is real life, but like we all have dozens and hundreds of arcs over the course of our lives. If you want to, you know, say like things are trying to work through in our lives, if you call that an arc, again, I'm using kind of weird term, kind of mixing real life and fiction here, but you get what I mean. Like, I think a decently well-written character is, they should have more than one quote-unquote arc that seems fine, because it doesn't resolve in their life in like 1 month or 3 months, whatever keeps coming up.
No, I'm not saying, I am applauding the show for continuing to develop this character. I'm just, only thing that's surprising me too is that we're doing it now. Like, so shortly right after, like, he had one, and, like, I don't know, it just seemed like we would be moving on to focus on a new character, is all I'm saying. It's just surprising to me that, like, oh, we're still doing Suguro stuff. Okay. Because it's a new arc, right? One thing
that I think ties into this maybe is that we actually haven't had that many new characters introduced since the very beginning of the series. Like, in terms of, like, the main cast, we really haven't had, many more new characters. So I think that gives the writer more time to develop all these characters, because they're not, like, just introducing new ones all the time. Like,
the anti-Bleach.
Yes, exactly. The main cast has pretty much been static since the beginning of the series. You have some new villains, either a villain of the week or a long arcing villains. We've definitely had more of those, but a lot of, like, the main cast has stayed the same since, I guess, since, like, episode 5 or whatever.
Yeah.
So just more time to develop people.
Yeah, I think this show overall has done a pretty good job with this core group. I think if I was to go back, like, a year and think back to when they were first starting to re-air the first season, my opinion of the show would have been like, yeah, it's all right. You know, it's not super memorable. But the more time I spend with these characters, I kind of like them more. And it feels like the author is giving them more to work with, more meat for their characters. And that's pretty much the episode. It ends pretty much with Lightning agreeing to make Suguro his apprentice. As far as my opinion, I thought it was pretty good. We obviously know, I think there was like a post-credit tease or something about like Yukio, you know, this is clearly going to be, he's going to be a focus of this new arc as well.
Oh, I'm not sure if you got a chance to mention it because it happened earlier in the episode, but there was that one point where like Shikami was like extremely perceptive that Yukio was kind of like hiding shit. And I was like, wow, girl, you have like the, I don't want to say, I feel like the default metaphor is like stirring gun or something, like just because we're showing kind of mindscape. But yeah, that she is a very perceptive woman. And like, Rin kind of also feels like Yukio is kind of like off, and like, so he kind of like has that same vibe too. But Shima was like dialed right in, like, Yukio is hiding shit from us. I can tell, I am 100% sure what the fuck is going on, Rin. And Rin's like, yeah, I kind of had that gist too. Maybe not as sharp as you, but like, obviously, as we play out further in the season, as Yukio does his, I guess, Virgil quest for more power or whatever the fuck happens, but. Yeah, I just commend her for being especially perceptive there. And even Rin for maybe not being as perceptive, but still he even understood that something was afoot. But like, only so much you can do, really. You can't like beat it out of Yuki or whatever, but let's hope Yuki.
Yeah, it adds to a level of believability between the characters that like, how they know each other and how long they've known each other, that yeah, like Shiemi is the type of person who would notice these things, and she like has tutored with Rin or with Yukio for a long time. And she notices that something's off. And of course she goes to Rin and is like, hey, have you noticed this too? You should speak to him about this. And Rin says, I did try to speak to him about this. Like, I'm not clueless. I'm his brother. He didn't say that, but it kind of, you know, it makes sense that Rin would also notice this. And he did ask him about it at the end of the last season. They haven't succeeded in getting anything out of Yukio yet. But these two characters, you know, obviously Shiemi and Rin are good friends, if not more, and they're kind of like confiding in each other about a common friend that they have, knowing that something's off. You know, it's a nice change of pace compared to some stories where you have like a character say, oh, it's nothing. And, you know, they have something that they're hiding that like is obvious that no one picks up on.
I'm glad you brought that scene up, Crocodile. I agree. That was a nice moment in this episode. And to clarify, what specifically got Shiemi to realize that something was wrong is that she mentions that Yukio was giving Rin the same face that Yukio always gave Shiemi. That she noticed that whenever Yukio would keep things to himself and bottle himself up or try to distance himself from Shiemi, he would always put on a smile and kind of like be like, oh, nothing's wrong. And she sees Yukio doing that to Rin now and recognizes that this isn't right, which is a nice touch.
Yeah, actually, there's one more thing I wanted to bring up from near the beginning of the episode. Basically, we're kind of discussing in previous podcasts about how people, a lot of people have, it's hard to trust Mephisto. He's like shady as hell motherfucker. And I thought it was interesting how Mephisto's like, I understand you guys don't trust me. And he was also kind of doing his way, his whole like, fuck you guys anyway, kind of mannerisms. But even he was like, if you don't trust me, note that I'm doing my best using my timey-wimey powers to hold back the emergence of this Gehenna gate. And it's actually affecting my body. Look at what it's doing to me. That's not to say I think he necessarily won over the rest of the Vatican or the other exorcists and whatnot. I think it's maybe understanding of on his part that he knows other people don't trust them, and he generally most of the time doesn't really care. But this is, I think, him putting an effort to be, guys, you know, fuck you guys. You hate me, I hate you, whatever. But we're still have a common cause, and you can at least trust me to at least keep my part of this battle going on, this bargain or whatnot. Even though don't trust me in other senses, but I am giving it my all, putting myself in line, actually hold a line against thinking whatever the Illuminati's plans are. So it is him saying, like, I know you guys don't trust me, and honestly, he's giving them good reasons to doubt him, but he's at least showing himself here that I'm still with you guys.
It's basically he's just like trying to play that he's not. He means it like truthfully, or he's just sort of playing himself to be like, you know, you can trust me because of this. He does show that he's been wounded by it. Okay. If nobody has anything else, we'll go ahead and move on to the next show, which is the season premiere of Mashal. Mashal, Season 2, Episode 1, Mash Burn Dead, and the Divine Visionaries. Which, I swore that was the title of a previous episode, but maybe not. So this was a pretty funny episode. I kind of have forgotten how funny this show can be. It starts out with a kind of flashback to the previous episode. And it includes the famous last scene of the previous season where everybody was going, yay! And they were just like jumping up and down and saying, yay! But as we remember last season, of course, it was revealed that Mash doesn't actually have powers. And so as they're walking out from that room, it literally takes place right when that last episode season ended. Mash is walking out with what's his face? I forget his name. Gosh darn it. Thank you. It's right here. Ray.
Oh, no, Finn. Rain is Finn's brother.
Oh, yeah. I had it backwards.
These are the divine visionaries that Sato's just posted.
Okay. Yeah, I
posted an image of the divine visionaries. I posted it because they come up later. So
Finn and they're walking out, and there's this guy who like comes up, another wizard who comes walking up. And he's got like a big pompadour. He's like, yo, man, I heard that you don't have magic, that you're non-magical. And he's basically trying to, you know, confirm this. And Mash does a really horrible job of trying to lie about it. And he's just like, well, I'm magical. You know, he does that kind of thing, which is really funny.
He kind of stammers through it.
And he starts sort of circling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then a couple more characters start walking up, one of which they just simply refer to as Sister Complex, or I think Mash does. He's like, hey, Sister Complex.
His real name is Lance. So I had to remind myself of all the different character names. Finn
You're
and
doing
Lance.
Better than me. And then basically they're all on their way to like their common room or whatever, because they're going to have like a little like dinner party type situation. And I think they sort of like alluded to this last season that they were like going to do this.
I think that's basically one of you after celebration, right? They were like after dinner doing like, yay, let's have a party, right? I think that's what happened.
Yeah, yeah, and even like the people that they had defeated, that were like they were invited, they were like willing to go to it, which is exactly what we see when we arrive into the party. Not only is their dorm mates there, but so are the past villains from the previous arc.
One of their names is Abyss Razor. Remember that?
Yeah, Abyss Razor is there. Yes, I forget. Is he the one with the eyeball? I can't remember.
Yeah, that's him. He's also apparently an incel, but you know.
Yeah, and then the guy with the puppets, like he's there as well. And the or sort of, it's the son of the, like Finn is, of course, like freaking out. He's like, oh my God. And then the girl is like kind of love, making everyone comfortable.
Her love is like, her name is like Love Passion or something, right?
Love Cute is also there. She doesn't do much, but she's also
love
around.
Love Passion was close, yeah.
Yeah, Love Cute's there. So it's just kind of a fun little party scene. It's mentioned.
There's a moment where like Lemon comes up and doesn't say much, but Abyss Razor starts freaking out, and then Abel says like, "Oh, he's not very good around women. He even calls them females."
Yeah, he's clearly like an incel or something. It's kind of dude needs.
So he's one of those characters, the ones that are like real macho and bravado, and then the moment a girl walks up, they go ooh, 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 and they freak out.
Well, he wasn't so macho in the previous season, but he's just
like, this is his new character quirk.
Yeah, he's just, I guess.
Okay. Macho's an exaggeration. He was confident in the previous, but the moment she walks up, he kind of changes.
There's also a part right around here where Lemon drops a cream puff, and Mash just like does like Superman strength suction to like suck it into his mouth.
Yes, which they turned into like the bump for the show. Yeah.
And then Lemon, of course, says something like, it's like I'm feeding you, like we're newlyweds.
Yes, she's still on that.
She's still obsessed with him.
During the party, it's brought up by one of the two bad guys that Mash is the target of Innocent Zero, that Innocent Zero is after Mash. Well, it's brought up because Innocent Zero actually takes over somebody. He like straight up like possesses them temporarily, I believe.
And I'm reminding myself, Innocent Zero is basically this show's version of Voldemort.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, we haven't seen his face. Meanwhile, while the party's going on, that Pompadour guy is sneaking around, trying to find out more about Mash. But he looks in and then freaks out when he sees all the big wigs are there, including the main bad guys, are hanging around the party. And then in true Harry Potter style, like everything in this show, an owl comes to deliver an important message to Mash. And it turns out that Mash has been issued a summons to an inquiry. The news of him being non-magical has apparently reached the show's version of the Ministry of Magic, which I think they call, I wrote it down here, they call it the Bureau of Magic. So, yeah. I'm going to say this one more time, and then I probably will try to avoid ever saying it again, but this show is like unbelievably a parody of Harry Potter, like to a nth degree. Like, it's not like, oh, they're kind of inspired by Harry Potter. No, it is almost dead up Harry Potter.
And they just like switch out a few words with a thesaurus. And just,
yes.
Oh, we can't do not ministry. What's another word for ministry? Bureau.
Bureau, yeah. Like, I mean, I get it. There are obviously bigger changes, like the fact that almost everyone's a wizard and there are very few non-wizards and, you know, and there's no Harry Potter here, I guess, and so forth. But so many references, like to the point that it's like absurd. So
we even mentioned that even the article or the episode titles are basically done in Harry Potter's book title style.
Yes. Yes. That's probably why I thought I'd heard it before. Now that you mention it.
Oh, that would make sense, actually, yeah.
Okay, so we cut back from the commercial break, and Mash is in the sort of Bureau of Magic, and he's being, like, there's a head guy there, and he's just being like, it's like, you can't, we've learned that you are a non-magical. They had a name for it, and it was Goofy. I wrote it down, but I don't think I wrote it in my notes.
Couldn't you say muggle? We all know what you mean.
Right, I just wanted, it was a funny word, though. Let me look it up real quick.
By the way, while you're looking that up, this like secondary headmaster's name, he's got a great name. You know what his name is? His name is Blessed Minister.
Okay. Blessed Minister.
That is normative determinism or whatever that phrase is at its finest. Like, your name is minister, you're born to be a minister.
Yeah, so the Muggle analog in the world of Mashal is someone who is called a lack magic. One word, lack magic. And there's a picture of bless minister. Bless that minister.
Bless you, Kazuthart.
Anyway, he's giving Mashal a talking down. And before he really gets an opportunity to kind of basically issue Mashal's like sentence, one of the divine visionaries shows up. This guy is named Ryo. It's spelled R-Y-O-H. And he's kind of, here, you've got the graphic right here. I can look him up.
Yeah, he's the Light King. He's magic. Yeah.
Ryo Grant. He is the Light King. And he, of all the ones we've seen so far, which of course we haven't like gotten deep into many of them because they just sort of, in this episode, we see them, but they might just say a word. So we don't get like a huge insight into their character. But the one thing I took away from Ryo is that he is like kind of the wild card of the group. He's very interested in Mash because he thinks Mash is like, you know, he's not completely anti-lack magic. He is kind of like finds Mash intriguing, where of all the other ones pretty much are like want to abide by the rules and follow the rules of like destroying and killing lack magics.
Yeah, so it kind of establishes that this group of divine visionaries are not always on the same page. Like they have in the last season we were only introduced to Rain barely, who is Finn's brother, and we're basically introduced to the rest, I think, here in this episode. But yeah, it's kind of immediately obvious that they're not always all in agreement, as you say.
Right. Before they show up though, Ryo decides he's going to test Mash. He says, if you really think you could become a divine visionary, I'm going to put you to the test and see if you can do the things that magic users can do. So he puts this, oh, by the way, he calls Mash Mushroom. That's his nickname. He calls him Mushroom. Anyway, he puts this candle down on the floor and he says, you have to light this candle without using any magic and you cannot touch it. And so Mash is like, okay. And so what he does is Mash takes his wand, which kind of surprises everybody, like, what? He's going to do something with the wand? But what he ends up doing is he just does the old, like, fire-starting trick where he just, like, I don't know, like, you know, grinds it onto the ground. And they're like, mentioning, is like, how can he do that? It's like, it's just marble. Like, there's no way that's going to work. But, of course, Mash being Mash, he does it at, like, a billion, you know, revolutions per second or whatever. And it's so powerful that it actually creates flames in the whole room around him, enough that the flames actually themselves touch the candle wick and light it on fire. So it's like he passes the
flame
test.
Whirlwind. It's kind of, yeah. Like, Mashal is ridiculous. Like, I think Ryo is perfectly reasoned to be interested in Mash because Mash is actually fucking ridiculous. So
yes,
anyone who isn't like blinded by their racism would be like, Mash is like, holy shit, are you Superman?
Right. Like, it's like Mash doesn't have magic, but he might as well have magic based on his physical ability. It's ridiculous. And this is when more of the visionaries show up. And I shouldn't say more. I say all of the visionaries show up. Does somebody want to go through these?
Sure. I will try. One
of note is Gaara, who is basically Orator. Like, he's kind of like the douche of the group. I guess I'll say, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler, but I'll say Kaldo doesn't really do much this episode, but he becomes pretty important later in the season. But the rest of these are mostly just kind of like faces who are just like, look at me, I'm here. And I say my quirky line, like the Ice Cane is like, I'm cold because I'm Ice Cane. Isn't that quirky? But yeah, I don't really, you know, do much besides not Gaara, who just wants to straight up murder Mash as hard as he can.
Yeah, I mean, so we're introduced to seven other divine visionaries in this episode. Order is the desert sand one. And he's the one who like actually attacks, you know, Mash here. The other five that aren't really introduced yet, but they're introduced, but we don't know them yet. They'll come later, I presume. There's Renatus or Renatus. He's the immortal Cane. Don't know what that means, but I guess he has some immortality power. Kaldo, the flame Cane. Ajito, the dragon Cane. Sofina, the knowledge Cane. And Surara, the ice Cane. So that's the other five. We don't know them yet, but they've been introduced.
We do get like a very brief kind of glimpse into their personality. Like Surara seems like she's very like demure and very like kind of nervous almost. Sophina seems very like, you know, serious.
Librarianess.
Yeah, very like knowledge. Yeah, she's obviously the knowledge king, but she seems like the smart one. I don't remember what Agito's like disposition is. The picture you have of him is just him sort of staring blankly.
He didn't say anything. I think his dragon actually said something. The pet dragon he has, it didn't say something.
Maybe.
But he himself did not say anything. He looked kind of like, he looked like he didn't really want to be there is how he looked. He didn't actually say anything. And I think his dragon maybe said something, but I could be wrong about that. But he didn't say anything.
Yeah. I kind of like this, though. This is, you know, this is pretty typical of a shonen, and I don't mind it. But this is like the, like, okay, here are the big bads that are going to be, like, playing a role in the future stories. So kind of setting all that up early.
I would also say, I guess, Renata's had a bit of that kind of delinquent vibe to him. Like, a little bit of rough and tumble kind of, you know, demeanor. If that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, Kaldo, I guess, gave off, you know, those not Gin vibes a little bit. But you'll see more of him later. But, you know, yeah.
So it's pretty much made clear here that they want to kill Mash because that's what you do with lack magics in this world. You don't like imprison them. You don't like make them second class citizens. No, you just straight up kill them. That's what you do.
Yeah, they established this in like the first two episodes of this series.
I will say most of these canes are like, obviously Rio's like, no, like let Mash, Mash is, you know, ridiculous. Let's not do anything hasty, whatnot. Let's chillax. We don't need to be raging racists here. Most of the other canes are kind of like, yeah, I guess those are the rules, whatever, shrug emoji. It's really Oruto who wants to, like, no, I want to, like, wipe, you know, murder this boy, this, like, I don't want to wipe just blood on the walls. Like, he's the one who has a murder boner here. I mean, he wipes it, like, we have to follow the rules. The rules are important, but he has a big murder boner here going on here.
Well, yeah, but so did Bless Minister, who was basically saying this is your sentence, so...
Oh, I thought we were talking about divine visionaries, though, about this group.
I know, but I'm just saying he's not. He's not the only person, is what I'm saying. Sure. Like,
right.
I think even the Pompadour guy mentioned it earlier in this episode. It's like, you know, you're going to be killed for that.
Oh, on that note, there is another character with like red hair who just kind of like showed up in this scene, and he was just kind of like a tertiary character, just like explaining stuff, just like here and there.
I
forget who. Yeah. Sorry?
He made the narrative joke, right?
Well, someone even mentioned, like, wait, who are you? Like, this random character just kind of shows up in this scene, and I don't even know his name. He's got, like, red fluffy hair, and he was there, and he just, like, had, like, a line here or there to, like, explain what's going on. But I thought that was just part of, like, the jokey nature of the show. Just some kind of extra character just shows up, and even one of the other characters like acknowledges him with a line that I think was something like, wait, who are you? What are you doing here? Just some other guy.
It was Mash, and Mash was just like, where did you come from? You know, because you're right. He's like an exposition character, kind of. He comes in and he's just like, oh my gosh, and he's reacting to everything. And I think the point is, the joke is that he's a nobody who just happens to be there.
There's another joke here that actually is not in your notes, but I guess you want to just keep going and we'll probably get to that point. But there was, a pretty big joke you missed here. But
well, is it about the narrator?
Yeah, like I was trying to say, because like, go ahead. I think you know what's
okay. Well, no, okay, it's whatever. He basically, you know, Mash is kind of like, you know, they're talking and you know they're going back and forth, and then that character with the big poofy hair is basically like, didn't you hear what the narrator just said? Like basically fourth wall breaking and pointing out the fact that the narrator had explained something really important and Mash wasn't paying attention to it.
Well, to be give more like detail, like while the divine visionaries and everyone are arguing about what to do with Mash, Blessed Minister jumps down to the ground and Innocent Zero starts speaking through him, or at least. I don't know if Innocent Zero himself or a member of Innocent Zero starts speaking through him because he has a parasite in the back of his neck controlling him. The narrative goes on about how this is a magical parasite that feeds off magical energy, and if anyone tries to remove it, it'll like jump onto them. And so Rio is like kind of going to remove it, being like, oh, I gotta be careful, gotta remove this. The Red Pompadour dude is saying to himself, not saying to himself, rather saying to the Light King, no, you can't do that. The parasite will possess you. Mash just rips the parasite off Blessed Minister. Basically eats it, spits it back out, tying with his tongue, and disables it. But then in that whole process, the Pompadour guy is sustained the penalty match. Then you just hear the narrator say that anyone who tries to remove the parasite will get possessed by a parasite. But of course, Mash will have no magical energy, just super physical strength. He's not weak to that, so Mash just doesn't give shit, defeats a parasite. That was the narrator joke and the whole thing.
Yeah, that's pretty great. Yeah, it was funny. Again, the show is more funny than I mean, it was always funny. I just kind of forgot that it was like this, I think. it was much more funny than I was expecting. But you're right. Yeah. It was, I do believe it was Blessed Minister that got taken over by Innocent Zero. And he declares war on the Bureau of Magic. And then that's when Dumbledore, whose name is Wahlberg, shows up. And basically enters the scene, and that's dun dun dun. He's there now. I do want to mention quickly too, like I was wrong about, I think I said earlier that somebody got possessed by Innocent Zero during the party, and I was mistaken. That's what happens here. That's when this happens, is when that possession takes place. Also, they mentioned too, like you kind of hinted at this, Crocodile, but like it's not. I mean, I believe Innocent Zero is a person, but they also kind of refer to Innocent Zero as a group in this conversation. It's a little weird how they did that. I don't quite get it.
Oh, it's the weird because Innocent Zero is a specific person, but the organization they run is, I think, also called Innocent Zero. So that kind of what makes it confusing.
Okay.
We don't see his face, but I think you hear his voice at the end of last season when I think Cell War wanted to speak with him after Cell War fought Mashal. So I think, Innocent Zero is both a person who's a leader of a group called Innocent Zero. I think that's how it works out. So it's a bit weird like that, yeah.
So that's this episode, the first episode of season two. Pretty funny. Like I said, the story, it's just picking up right where it's going to leave off. We know from previews that this is going to be a tournament arc type thing because it's a tournament for the Divine Visionary. But we're kind of kicking off by setting up the premise of the Divine Visionaries themselves and what they bring to the story. So pretty cool. Any thoughts on this?
No, it was just, is MASH like the most exciting, most compelling show in the world? No, but it's kind of goofy and fun and silly, and I'll take it.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I feel like I'm expecting this show at some point to kind of, I might lose my interest with it, but I'm certainly not even close to that yet, because I feel like if anything, this episode made me more interested to watch it, because you're right. This is not a compelling story, but the show doesn't take itself serious enough. So at least it hasn't yet. And that's good to me because it's more entertaining when it's trying to be silly and funny. So.
Yeah, I would say MASH is a series that basically has one joke, but like they get a lot of mileage out of the joke.
Yeah. I think this episode's a good example of that.
One thing I want to mention, just narrow speaking, is that Reigns shows up with Wahlberg. Actually throws one of his magical swords to break up a fight between Orator and Mashal. But I just want to mention that quickly because we mentioned Wahlberg coming in, but Reigns is with him as well.
Yeah, I kind of forgot that Reign wasn't here with the others until you mentioned that. Okay, so that's Mashal. Let's move on to the last show, the last premiere of this weekend, which is One Piece. One Piece episode 751. Curtain up on a new adventure. Arriving at the Phantom Island, Zoo. Now, this is a 22-minute episode of which I would say 17 minutes is just a recap. It is a recap for One Piece. Barto explaining to his crew, who should know all this, by the way, how each of the Straw Hat members joined the Straw Hat crew. That's the episode, most of it.
Except Vivi, most notably.
Well, yeah, that's true.
I assume just because the stuff that would now was kept a secret, so, and no one told him, so he doesn't know, but.
Yeah.
I mean, yep, that's what it was.
So yeah, that's unfortunate. I kind of was really excited for the arc to begin, but they really, really don't start it. Again, in the last 3 or 4 minutes of the episode is when actually the actual Zoe arc begins. It starts with a brief scene where we see Kizaru back at Navy headquarters, and he's getting a report given to him about Edward Vivel, who appears to be the son of Whitebeard. So this is not super important, but it's just sort of like a, hey, bigger world stuff going on. You might want to remember this for someday in the future.
Have you been introduced to this character before?
It showed like a silhouette of Edward Vivel. Kind of looks like a beast man of some sort. I don't know, but...
Yeah, you only see him from behind. No, I don't think Crocodile, we've ever seen him before. I think this is the first time he's been mentioned.
I'm gonna risk it. I'm gonna go to the One Piece wiki. I'm just gonna see what episode it says he was. Episode 751 is when he's first debuted. So, yep, that's this episode.
Yeah, this is the introduction of this character. But I'll just warn you. I'll just tell you right now. He has not played a big role in the story.
That's actually the reason why I checked it, and that's also like one thing that the One Piece wiki does pretty well. And other wikis, but One Piece Wiki especially, is it lists out on the sidebar like when a character was first mentioned or first shown, because that's the type of series this is, where Edward Vivel is being shown now, and then I don't know, 500 episodes from now he'll become important, and then 500 episodes from now we'll be like, when did they mention him before? It's right. Yeah. Here. So yeah.
So I think everything in the rest of the episode is canon from this point on. So we cut back to Bartolomeo's ship. And the joke is that Bartolomeo's crew are getting seasick, which is, you know, silly. It's like they're pirates. How can they be seasick? And there's all this fog everywhere. It's getting really hard to see where they're going. Usopp's getting a little spooked. He's getting a little afraid of everything. I think there's a moment here where Law like refers to Usopp as God. He calls him God.
Yes. He just calls him God.
I don't remember that.
Yep. And then, first of all, there's also a part when like the boat gets hit by a lightning bolt, and it's just kind of shrugged off, kind of like a joke or like an animation joke. But I think the point is just like the weather around Zoe is very tumultuous and bad. Law calls Usopp God, and then they kind of mention that, like, he kind of mentions like, yeah, you're basically one of the biggest targets on the crew now. Enjoy. And Usopp, of course, freaks out.
Yeah. And there was a funny shot too for a moment when it cuts back to like a reacting Usopp, and then you see like Franky towering behind him. And I'm not sure what that's supposed to entail. Like, is he saying that like Franky is like...
Franky was jealous in the previous episodes that his bounty was not quite 100,000 or whatever.
That must have been it then. Okay. I thought that was what it was, but I wasn't 100% sure. But Law says, no, we're going the right way, because I've got the Vivre card from one of my crew members here, and he puts it in his palm, and you can see it's still moving forward. So yeah, we're moving in the right direction. We're gonna run into Zoe soon. And he says, in fact, he starts to explain, and he's like, Zoe is a wandering island. It doesn't have a fixed spot. That's why you can't use a log pose to find it. And then it's, of course, revealed why it's a mysterious phantom island, which because it's not an island at all. Zoe is literally a giant elephant with a country on its back.
Sure. And apparently also this elephant is like 1,000 years old.
So I have questions. So are Nami, Sanji, and the rest of the crew that's separated from the others, they are at Zoe, so they're on top of this giant elephant? That's where they are right now?
I think so. That's what we're led to believe anyway.
Yeah.
So how do you get on the elephant has to be submerged, I guess, and stationary to get on the island, and it gets up and moves around? Because I don't know how you have a functioning island if you're on the back of an elephant, because how do you get like supplies out and other stuff? And I don't understand how the mechanics that I work entirely. I mean, granted, it's One Piece, it's fantasy. I guess I'm not supposed to think too hard about it, but I'm thinking a little bit about it.
It's okay to think about it. I'll pull a crocodile here and say that's going to get explained.
Okay, fair enough. All right.
But yes, yeah, you bring up a good point, Seda. Law also mentions that this thing is over 1,000 years old, because he mentions that humans have been banned from visiting the island of Zoe for over 1,000 years. And he says that it is the home of the minks. then that's where the episode ends.
And we can see in the opening of the show what a mink looks like, probably, I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah, I saw there were, like, dog people and all that stuff, and I guess,
like, this is probably not a
spoiler, but just from cultural osmosis, I think, is Carrot, like, the bunny girl, she a minx, too?
Maybe.
Okay.
All I know is the opening shows a few characters.
I've got to ask you right now, did either of you guys know that Zoe was going to be a giant elephant?
No.
I did not.
It's really great. I think this whole reveal works so much better for non-Japanese viewers because Zoe is literally the word elephant in Japanese.
Yeah, I saw someone post it on the thread, but I didn't know that before, yeah. Like 2 days ago or whatever. So,
yeah, so that kind of
literally
works.
Just calling the island elephant.
Yep.
Like, by the way, Elephant Island is on an elephant. Surprise.
Yeah. And that's pretty much where the episode ends. So we are, yeah, I think from this point forward, we're into normal canon. We should be out of the filler.
It feels like Toei just taking the opportunity, like, okay, we just did a filler arc of 4 episodes. We can fill one more. We got one more at us, right? So that we can stretch out before we actually start the arc. Let's do a recap.
You know, I say that, and I haven't looked ahead to see how much more filler there is, if there's any. I don't think there is, but I guess I could be wrong. But
I could be wrong, but my understanding was that the filler arc we just had was like the last true filler arc, and now filler is most interspersed into canon, or did someone lie to me about that?
I don't remember. It could be. But yeah, we're at Zoe. And yes, you bring up a great question, Crocodile. The country of Zoe is on the back of the elephant, and the elephant is huge. How do you get up there? How do you get to there? How do you do that? That's a good question. We'll find out really soon.
What were those little shell things in Skypiea called? I forget what they're called. We need more of those.
Impact dials?
Yeah, those. We need super impact dials to, like, get up the elephant.
Yeah, so I'm excited to see more of this arc. I remember liking this arc. It's not like I said, it's one of the shorter arcs at only like 29 episodes. And it's not like, it's kind of interesting. I'm not going to give too much away other than to say that, like, it's a mix of like, oh, it's a new place, but it's also got some pretty deep connections to the overall story of One Piece, like the big picture stuff. So there's some stuff to look forward to in this arc that's really going to change the overall huge narrative of One Piece. So I don't want to oversell it because I don't think it's like the most amazing arc or anything, but I'm just kind of prepping you to be like, hey, there's stuff to look forward to here. It's really neat.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to it.
My understanding from, again, just from cultural osmosis, it goes Zoe to Whole Cake, and then after Whole Cake, we get into Wano. Just Whole Cake and Wano are just super long. Is that a correct understanding of what's going on?
Yeah, Whole Cake is pretty long too. I mean, there's also there's some other stuff around Whole Cake, and there's some other stuff around Wano where there's like mini arcs that kind of break off. But yeah. And that is One Piece. Anything else about this episode? I mean, again, there wasn't much. It was all recap mostly.
Oh, there's one thing I do want to mention. In the flashbacks, they were kind of going over the Luffy versus Kuro fight. And noticed that Kuro sounded exactly like Supreme Kai. And I think it may have been you, Seto, who mentioned that Supreme Kai and Kuro have the same voice actor. But my question was, oh, is that a new thing? Or has that always been the way? And I think you mentioned that had always been the way. And then to my knowledge, I don't recall Kuro sounding so much like Supreme Kai in the past, even if they're the same voice actor. So that makes me think maybe since he had just like one or two lines here, he didn't really bother to like go into his Kuro voice, but maybe it was just me who was like, that doesn't sound like Kuro. That sounds like he's off or something. Like, was
I don't remember. You mean Captain Kuro? I don't remember what he sounded like.
Fair enough.
Yeah, it's possible some of these were recast. So
I was actually wondering if some of these lines were just from like the original episode, just replayed, or some of them were. I know some of the lines were new, but like, I was wondering if any of the lines were just from the original episode and they just like replayed it. I doubt it, but I don't know.
I think it may have been Grand who told me that Captain Kuro and Supreme Kai always had the same voice actors. So that might be where I got that from. But I don't know. Like, my memory of what Captain Kuro used to sound like does not sound exactly like Supreme Kai, whereas he sounded exactly like Supreme Kai here. So I just wonder myself, with my memory off, did the voice actor change, or did the voice actor just turn in different performance? And it seems like it might be C, or like maybe A, maybe I need to go back and revisit it, but I guess it might be C. But that was just something that stuck out to me. Like, wow, Captain Kuro sounds exactly like Supreme Kai. And that just stood out to me for some reason.
Anyways, Robin's line in Water 7 was clearly the same line. Like, don't make the voice actors do that again.
Yeah.
Some of them, I'm sure, were from the original.
Well, I'll tell you one thing they certainly didn't reuse, and that was the animation. And I'm sorry, One Piece, but these reanimated scenes look like dog shit.
Yeah.
They were bad. Like, I mean, it would have been way better to just reuse the original animation in 4.3 because these look bad.
I guess they would have been too jarring with the borders and stuff, I guess. That was their rationale.
Well, here's the thing. You have an opportunity to reanimate a classic moment from anime. They don't even remotely do it justice. It just, like, characters don't even look like they're on model. It looked bad. I'm just like, they were hard to watch.
You're not wrong. Though I do feel like this is probably not the type of episode they would waste their A-team or their resources or whatever to, like, you know, put in their maximum effort. Like, if, you know, you're totally correct. Well,
we're years away from One Piece finally realizing that we need to start animating this show better. We're still years away from that, unfortunately. So, okay, that's it for One Piece. Exciting new stories to be had. No more Dressrosa. So, do we want to talk about flavor alerts? I don't think there's really anything. It's too early, right?
Play flavor alert.
Potential award nominations.
Bless Minister.
Yeah, that's how I was going.
Okay, do we got to put Bless Minister on the list? Okay.
I mean, who knows if he even shows up again in the show? I don't know, but...
I think he's been there before, so he's possible.
He's like a part character, a bit character, that, you know. But yeah, why not? That's a stupid name. It's a fun name. Let's go for it.
I like it. That's the episode title for me. Let me find the list here. I'll add them. Anything else? I don't know about these Bleach names, man.
Yeah, none of the Bleach names or even the Mashal Divine Visionary's names, you know. Gerard Valkyrie is kind of funny, but not really. It's like, oh yeah, his name is Valkyrie, and he kind of looks like a Valkyrie.
It's only funny because it's so straightforward compared to the vast majority of Quincy's.
Yes.
It's like, you got these Quincy's like Shama the Doo and Gablaga and then Bob. It's like, okay, that kind of stands out for, you know.
Yeah. You want Blessed Minister for name, right?
Yes, name. Just name.
Okay.
You know, I'm impressed by the amazing backstory, deep character motivations of Blessed Minister, and his, you know, he's so talented and such a great orator, and his power set is such unbelievable.
He's a great foil for Mashal or Mash.
Yeah. Well, we've come full circle because the first four entries into nominations into this category are all Mashal character names.
I mean, it makes sense. It's one of the things the show is good at, for better or worse.
Anything else?
I was thinking any power or ability from like any of these One Piece characters, are any of those cool enough?
One Piece characters.
Not One Piece, Bleach. Sorry, okay. Bleach. I meant Bleach.
Bleach? Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just saying, in terms of powers and abilities, like, the Royal Guard really hasn't had a chance to flex yet. So, like, I would save that discussion till next season, see if you feel it might be worthy for nominations. But, like, the Royal Guard are the Royal Guard for a reason, but we have not seen them really do anything yet. And I don't think that's a spoiler to say that. Like, I mean, the fact that the show continues for two more seasons, I think, is not really a spoiler. But, you know, involves even you shit, but...
Now, you say two more seasons. There's the season that has still been made, but there's one more season about to premiere, right?
Yes, there's a third season, which is already premiered in Japan, and it's already been dubbed, and I'm sure Toonami will continue right into it. And then there's the fourth season, which has not premiered in Japan yet. It's supposed to be sometime next year. I'm not sure if it's first quarter or second quarter of next year, but sometime next year. And that'll be the final season of his arc. And that last season will contain likely a good chunk of original material, like new to the not in the manga, new to the anime kind of stuff. Like, the anime has been adding a lot already. This is kind of Kubo's director's cut of this arc. We've talked about this before, but yeah, so the anime's already added a lot to the arc, but the fourth season is going to be mostly new stuff rather than the first three seasons, which are mostly from the manga editions. The fourth season will be like almost all new stuff.
Sounds like Kubo's pulling an Evangelion here.
Yeah, the ending of the arc in the manga is much maligned, and I think Kubo was kind of like really in poor health when he was finishing up, and he was like, okay, I need to stop or else I'm going to die or something of that sort. But now, obviously, it's been like many years. He's obviously in a better place physically, mentally, and I think even he himself like wants to kind of redo, and it happens to Bleach is in a popular enough spot that he gets that chance, whereas very many manga don't. So like, he's going to take it and give it his all, I guess, and hopefully come up with a better ending.
All right. Well, I think that'll do it for the... We don't need a whole bunch of nominations this week, because, again, so many shows just started.
Just before we head out, I don't want to keep us too much longer, but I just did want to say about Daima. I heard your guys' conversation the other week. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to show because my internet crapped out. But I do think basically where you ranked it seemed like about right. Maybe I'll put it a little higher or so, but like I think it was the logic is correct. Like, you can't be it has to be below Kai, just because Kai is basically the director's cut of Dragon Ball Z, and Dragon Ball Z is one of the most influential anime of all time. So obviously Daima is not going to supersede that. I did think Daima was a fun show that had immaculate production. They learned their lessons from Super, and I think probably Toriyama just really wanted to, you know, be done well and proper. I think it did a pretty good mix of classic Dragon Ball with, you know, good Dragon Ball Z antics. Some things didn't quite deliver. Like, it felt like there were some parts that kind of like written in contrast to each other. Like, we talked about the weird thing with Super Saiyan 4, that a few moments like that felt like maybe different parts of the show were kind of fighting with each other. I think even regardless of all of that, it still turned in pretty enjoyable Dragon Ball material. And I think it'll just make a generally good addition to the Dragon Ball canon, or as much as there is a canon. I'm glad I showed up with Toonami. I did enjoy the show as much as the rest of you guys. And if it had to be Toriyama's last work, I think maybe it wasn't left on the... Maybe it didn't go out on the highest possible bar. But I think he went on a pretty good bar. And I think... honestly, I don't know his opinions on the final show, but I would have think he probably would have, for the most part, been happy with what was produced. Send off to Daima, obviously, is another send off to Toriyama, who obviously, you know, gave him his condolences and his peace, you know, last year when the news dropped. But, you know, rest in peace again. And of course, like the rest of you, I'm kind of curious to see what they do next in Dragon Ball IP. I think there had been a protracted legal battle between Shueisha Bird Studio, which is Toriyama's studio that he founded to manage his properties, and I think some other IP holders. And I think that just only recently got settled. I forgot who won out in that struggle, but I think the fact that it recently got settled is why we're getting a whole bunch of new Dragon Ball announcements, and why they're going to announce something in January. Don't know what exactly. Maybe might have to do with the Dragon Ball Z Fighters revival in some sense, maybe. I'm curious to see what the next step for the Dragon Ball franchise is. But I think Daima overall left a pretty good impression. It had its issues, but I thought it was a pretty good show overall.
Yep, agreed. Okay, well, thank you for giving your thoughts there. That will do it for episode 449. Thank you for being here, Seda.
Yep.
And thank you, Crocodile.
My pleasure.
And we will see you guys next week for more Bleach, Blue Exorcist, Mashal, and One Piece. And until then, later.